Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Attention, science freaks. I'd like to open today's show talking about something really important in evaluating scientific studies, and that is conflict of interest. And I'd like to read this article, Dishonest Doctors, from nutritionfacts.org. One of the critical questions to ask whenever reading a medical journal article is who funded the study. In most journals, researchers are required to identify their sources of funding. So what's the problem? Well, researchers can obscure the true origin of financial support. They can hide it, disguise it, or even launder the money through a front group. A case in point is a study downplaying the risks of lung cancer that was funded in part by the Foundation for Lung Cancer Early Detection, Prevention, and Treatment. That doesn't sound so bad until you realize it was underwritten by millions of dollars from a tobacco company. There's no obligation to disclose a funding source's source of funding, which allows companies to evade financial disclosure requirements and make it harder to follow the money trail. Why does a funding source matter? Every single one of 8 reviews covering over 1,000 studies found that research funded by industry is more likely to make conclusions that are favorable to industry. For example, why do some review articles on the health effects of secondhand smoke reach different conclusions than others? The only factor found was whether an author was affiliated with the tobacco industry. This is a disturbing finding. It suggests that far from conflict of interest being unimportant in the objective and pure world of science, it is the main factor determining the result of studies. Not that we'd even know, because 77% of authors failed to disclose the source of funding. And that's another problem. The responsibility to disclose funding sources is left entirely up to the authors. So how many researchers divulge the truth? Evidently, a law was passed in Denmark requiring physicians to register any time they worked with industry, which allowed researchers to cross-reference the studies physicians published to see how honest they were. 48% of the time, the conflicts of interest were not disclosed, reinforcing a perception that physicians simply don't take conflict of interest seriously, or at least Danish physicians don't. What about the United States? Historically, there had been no means of confirmation or verification when an American doctor said they had no conflict of interest. Then in 2007, hip and knee replacement companies were forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in fines for giving orthopedic surgeons illegal kickbacks. Many orthopedic surgeons in the country made decisions predicated on how much money they could make, choosing which device to implant by going to the highest bidder. We expect doctors to make decisions based on what is in the best interest of their patients, said the Department of Justice's U.S. Attorney of the District of New Jersey, not the best interest of their bank accounts. Part of the settlement was that the companies would have to make public all the payments they made to physicians. The release of those records offered a rare opportunity to see if physicians were telling the truth on disclosure forms. And, lo and behold, more than half of payments were not disclosed, totaling millions of dollars. That was for surgeons and medical device companies. What about doctors and drug companies? The same thing happened. Drug companies were forced to disclose who they were paying off. In looking at the publications of the doctors who got the most money, at least $100,000, the study found that they were worse than the surgeons in 69% of the cases. They failed to disclose their industry ties. The problem is that we just assume researchers are going to be honest and tell the truth. But these findings suggest that the accuracy and completeness of conflict of interest disclosures cannot be assumed. So, even when a paper says no conflict of interest, who knows if it's really true? A longtime editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine wrote a scathing piece on drug companies and doctors who failed to disclose hundreds of thousands of dollars from drug companies like GlaxoSmithKline, which had been fined literally billions of dollars for activities such as bribing and suppressing data. When GlaxoSmithKline got results that were commercially unacceptable, the company just buried them. Billions of dollars in fines gets assessed, but for drug companies, that may just be the cost of doing business. As reprehensible as many drug industry practices are, such as the medical profession, much of the medical profession is even more culpable. We can expect drug companies to prioritize the bottom line, but maybe we should expect more from the healing profession. And I'd like to take this time just to comment a little bit on WAKT, a non-commercial radio station preferring locally produced content like this show just for the health of it. I am personally committed not only making this show non-commercial, but make it anti-commercial and try to expose corruption, conflicts of interest, and other types of things that might actually show how commercial interests twist and distort science, in this case about public health and health. I'd also like at this point to take a little bit of personal privilege. A couple months ago, the University of Toledo opened up an exhibit called Protest, Activism and Social Change from 1845 to 2015. And this has been showing for the last couple months and will be showing through December 16th at the Kennedy Center for Special Collections at the University of Toledo. I was actually really, they have a really nice, the exhibit's free, and they also have a free program booklet that's rather large that documents a lot of their exhibit. But I was really delighted, since I haven't kept my own personal archives. I was the AIDS program director for the then Lucas County Health Department, basically the whole decade of the 90s. And one of the projects we worked on circa 1995 was a poster that said "Condoms Stop AIDS." And one thing I really thought was ingenious about it is we put on that poster, we taped little pads of paper that would talk about where you could get free condoms and also show where you could have HIV test sites, so you could just peel off a little thing and have the information right along with you. Along with that particular initiative, we did produce and distribute tens of thousands of HIV testing and counseling cards, little wallet foldover cards that people could easily access that gave all the contact information and locations for HIV testing in the Toledo area. I would have to note, though, that my other activism, since this is a display and a exhibit about activism, a number of years ago when there was a certain presidential election and one of the vice presidents was coming to speak while campaigning for a one then President Barack Obama, now president presidential candidate, hopeful Joe Biden, was coming to UT to speak for a campaign event. And I took the opportunity to post a whole bunch of stickers to polls that were anti-war messages, anti-drone messages. I happened to be stopped by the UT police, and based on that stop, was banned from UT campuses, I guess indefinitely. I'm not sure that's constitutional, but I was banned indefinitely. So ironically, more proud than even having this HIV/AIDS poster documented in their collection and their program booklet is the fact that I actually went to an exhibit about protest apparently illegally since I'm banned from actually being on the UT campuses. And it is in that spirit of resistance that I bring you my reporting. Now let's go to the public health news and research roundup, where I search and collect and synthesize public health news and research so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, first up, a story highlighting how the built environment, the environment that humans build around them, is important for public health and safety. This from Kaiser Health News. Child drowning rates drop as communities adopt stricter building codes. Drowning rates for children age 14 and younger are now about one-third of what they were in the early 1980s. Experts say state and local laws that require more fencing and security features around family swimming pools have made a difference, along with increased awareness of the dangers of letting young children swim alone. Despite the improvements, drowning remains the nation's leading injury-related cause of death for children ages 1 to 4, and children in that age group are most likely to drown in a swimming pool rather than a natural body of water. Often drowning is silent. It happens in 20 to 60 seconds. Parents don't realize how quickly that can happen to their children. Nadina Rigsby, founder and president of the California-based Drowning Prevention Foundation, said the sharp decline in accidental drownings in California is a direct outgrowth of strict, uniform building codes. We have the strongest, most stringent pool fencing law in the nation, in the world, actually, Rigsby said. We suggest to other states, why don't you mirror the California law? National safety organizations continue to push for more states and cities to adopt uniform standards and have embraced as a model the International Swimming Pool and Spa Code. The code requires physical barriers around pools and sets standards on gates and latches. So far, 21 states and more than 180 local agencies have adopted the code. Okay, next up from the New York Times. Rabies kills tens of thousands yearly. Vaccinating dogs could stop it. Worldwide, about 59,000 people a year die from rabies, most in Africa and Asia. 99% of them because they were bitten by a rabid dog. About 40% of the victims are children, according to the World Health Organization, which has announced a campaign to reduce human deaths from dog-transmitted rabies across the globe to zero by 2030. The World Health Organization estimates the death toll in India alone is at about 20,000 a year. Mission Rabies, which is part of a worldwide veterinary service and supported partly by Dogs Trust Worldwide, both nonprofits, have targeted Goa as a place to demonstrate the viability of its program to stop the spread of canine rabies. It spends about $300,000 a year and has vaccinated 100,000 dogs a year since 2017, about 50,000 a year before that. Deaths of people from rabies in Goa fell to zero last year from 15 in 2014 when the campaign started. There are none so far in 2019. The program has gained the full support of the state government, which now contributes about $70,000 per year, and its work is widely recognized as effective. Ryan Wallace, a veterinarian who heads the rabies epidemiology unit at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and who has collaborated with Mission Rabies in Haiti, said its effort in Goa is one of the most successful programs in lower and middle income countries that I've seen in a decade. Rabies has been eliminated in dogs throughout much of North America and Europe. India accounts for about a third of rabies deaths from dogs, but the disease is endemic in 120 countries. Attaining global eradication is the goal of anti-rabies organizations, but most see it as an aspiration, not a likely achievement. Not because the science is difficult or the practical methods are unproven. Medically, rabies is easy to prevent in dogs and people. Organizationally, the path to stopping rabies is well understood. But, like all public health problems, rabies control depends on large and continuing government action. Eradication of canine rabies in a dog population, which is how human rabies deaths drop to zero, requires a long-term commitment. To reach zero human deaths, the 120 countries in which the disease is endemic would need to find the money and act efficiently now. Even in India, with a powerful central government, Manika Gandhi, a member of parliament and a widow of Indira Gandhi's son Sanjay, as well as a former government minister and animal welfare activist, said rabies is not really a priority issue with the government, unfortunately. Goa is an exception that Mission Rabies hopes can lead the way, if not for the globe, then for India, and if not for India, then for other countries. The state government is fully behind the program of Mission Rabies, which has published data that not only shows it is remarkably effective at reasonable cost, but also offers lessons on what needs to be done to stage effective anti-rabies campaigns, vaccinating dogs. Case by case, rabies is the most lethal disease known. The virus enters the body at the time of a bite. It then begins to travel up nerves toward the brain. In humans, once it reaches the brainstem, usually after about 2 weeks, but perhaps months later, it starts to cause excessive salivation, convulsions, impaired movement, sensitivity to light and noise, and sometimes avoidance of water. Once symptoms appear, it is nearly 100% fatal, but it can be prevented even if a person is infected with the virus. A series of shots, given before symptoms appear, can stop the virus in its tracks. In most cases, and in most parts of the world, rabies is a death sentence. The patient is kept isolated and tied to a bed in a dark room. Death is often preceded by seizures, pain, and hallucinations. The disease is described in texts from Greek and Roman antiquity, and in an ancient Ayurvedic text, the Sushruta Samhita, some of the old records suggest an understanding that it was the saliva that transmitted the disease, but it wasn't until Pasteur developed his vaccine more than a century ago that anything could be done. Rabies perfectly illustrates the concept of one health, the idea that the health of human and animal populations are inextricably tied together. If cattle have tuberculosis, it can spread to people. An Ebola reservoir in apes or bats can spread to humans. For rabies, the link is direct. Wherever there are people, there are dogs. If dogs are suffering and dying from rabies, humans will also suffer and die. In essence, if you save dogs, you save humans. The consensus among rabies experts is that if the level of vaccination in the dog population can be kept at 70% over a period of 7 years, the variant of the rabies virus that thrives in dog populations will disappear. Mission Rabies estimates the vaccination cost per dog, including salaries and other costs, at $2.50, far lower than the cost of treating humans, which involves not only a more expensive vaccine, but also potential hospital stays. By that accounting, every dog in India could theoretically be vaccinated for under $90 million. India now spends $490 million a year on post-bite treatment, Dr. Gibson estimated. Okay, good example of public health at work. I haven't heard anything from the anti-vaxxers, but hopefully they're not opposed to vaccinating dogs to eliminate rabies in both dogs and human beings. Okay, next up from Science Daily. Nations with strong women's rights likely to have better population health and faster growth. Nations with strong women's rights are more likely to have better health and faster growth than those who don't promote and protect these values. This trend is evident in resource-poor countries, says the researchers. While many parts of the world have made good economic progress, women's rights have often been overlooked. This is despite many countries having signed the International Bill of Rights for Women, formerly known as the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The researchers wanted to find out if there might be a link between protection of women's rights and health improvement and sustainable development, and if ultimately women's rights might have more of an impact than economic and social or civil and political rights alone. They analyzed databases which held information on health, human rights, and economic and social rights for 162 countries for the period 2004 to 2010. Countries were grouped according to the respect they afforded to women's economic and social rights. 44 countries were in the high category, 51 in the moderate, and 63 in the poor category. Poor rights. Analysis of the data showed that strong economic and social rights were associated with better or improving health outcomes, possibly because of the spending on health per head of the population. But this wasn't the case when looking at countries based on women's economic and social rights. Overall, countries with strong women's rights had better or improving health than those where women's rights were only moderately or poorly respected. These health indicators include disease prevention, such as vaccination, reproductive health, death rates, and life expectancy. In countries where human rights, to include women's rights, were highly respected, but where access to hospital beds and doctors were nevertheless below average, health outcomes were still consistently better than average. The results confirm that even with a lack of resources, if a country has a strong human rights structure, the health outcomes are better. But countries where civil and political rights alone were highly valued had varying levels of health. And despite some countries respecting economic, social, and cultural rights, they still didn't protect women's economic and social rights. But gender equality is not just a women's issue, but a development issue, they suggest. Today, the value of human rights has often been questioned from an economic standpoint. However, our data find that rather than limit progress, human rights, and women's economic and social rights in particular, can only benefit from them, they conclude. This actually isn't anything new. I remember in graduate school way back in the day in the 80s in an international health course talking about the single most important factor for predicting development of a country. That was the status of women. This remains true. Honor your women, people, and we all do better. Okay, next up, as in the Boston Globe, an editorial, Can We Afford Medicare for All? By several physicians from Physicians for a National Health Program. Would Medicare for All break the bank? Proponents contend that it could cover the uninsured and upgrade coverage for just about everybody else without swelling our nation's already hefty health care bill. But critics retort that the cost of such an expansion would be exorbitant, even prohibitive. Too often, however, this debate plays out in the absence of good evidence. But our new research published in the Annals of Internal Medicine may change that. Universal coverage might increase costs for one big reason. When the uninsured get coverage, or the underinsured get better coverage, they're likely to use more health care. For example, a study begun in the 1970s randomized thousands of people into different health care plans and found that those with better coverage use more health care. This sort of evidence drives estimates that Medicare for All, by expanding coverage, could cause U.S. healthcare spending already at $3.5 trillion a year to further swell. And yet, nations with universal coverage spend less, much less, than the United States on healthcare. What explains this paradox? To find out, we analyze how the two biggest coverage expansions in U.S. history, the implementation of Medicare in 1966 and the Affordable Care Act in 2014, affected hospital utilization. In both of these expansions, about 10% of Americans gained coverage, a similar percentage as would gain coverage under Medicare for All. But contrary to expectations, neither Medicare nor the ACA caused an overall increase in hospital use. Before Medicare startup, the hospitalization rate was 12.8 per 100 Americans. Afterwards, it was 12.7. Similarly, before the ACA, the hospitalization rate was 9.4 per capita. After, it was 9.0. As expected, however, the newly covered did get more care. With Medicare, hospitalizations increased among the elderly, about half of whom were uninsured before Medicare, particularly among low-income seniors. Yet those increases were counterbalanced by small reductions in hospitalizations among younger and wealthier people. Effects after the Affordable Care Act were more subtle, but we again saw evidence that it shifted admissions from wealthier Americans to low and middle income ones, and from the healthy to the sick. But again, overall hospital use didn't rise. The most likely explanation for these shifts in utilization is Romer's Law, named for Milton Romer, a pioneering health policy expert who studied the relationship between the number of hospital beds in a community and the use of those beds. As the number of beds rises, he asserted, so does the number of nights that patients spend in them. Or as he put it back in 1959, a hospital bed built is a filled bed. Romer's Law has been borne out by many studies over the years, and it implies that if the number of beds in a community is finite, increases in insurance coverage usually won't translate into more bed use. As physicians, we have seen Romer's Law in action. While some hospitalizations are due to emergencies, many are elective. And when hospitals have many empty beds, the number of elective procedures and hospitalizations rises. Elective procedures are not necessarily a good thing, and well-insured patients sometimes receive unnecessary, even harmful care. For instance, while implanting defibrillators or stents into diseased hearts can be life-saving, These potentially dangerous devices are sometimes overused, inserted into many patients who won't benefit from them. The same is true of many other tests and surgical procedures, leading to the Institute of Medicine to conclude that nearly one-third of medical spending is wasted. It's not surprising, then, that when expanded coverage caused small reductions in hospitalizations for wealthier, healthier people, no one seemed to complain, or for that matter, even notice. Indeed, by producing offsets in unnecessary care, universal coverage might actually benefit those of us lucky enough to already have good insurance. Overall, our finding that coverage expansions do not cause a surge in hospital use is reassuring. It implies that universal coverage via Medicare for All could enhance care for those who need it without breaking the bank. Conversely, it suggests that shrinking coverage, for instance, by repealing or overturning the Affordable Care Act, would save little in healthcare costs, even as it deprived millions of the care they need. Past projections of the likely costs of universal coverage for the United States assume that expanded coverage would increase hospital use and raise costs. But that assumption is wrong. The history of Medicare and the Affordable Care Act, together with experiences of nations with national health insurance around the globe, shows that covering everyone is not just the right thing to do, it's also something we can afford to do.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, next up, from Inside Climate News, world hunger rises with climate shocks, conflict, and economic slumps. The combined forces of climate change, conflict, and economic stagnation are driving more people around the world into hunger, reversing earlier progress, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization reported. Although the numbers fluctuate as countries rise and fall, conflicts come and go, and climate emergencies intensify and recede, the prevalence of hunger remains stubbornly high. In 2015, rates of hunger began to rise after decades of progress. And while the rates have now stabilized, the overall number of undernourished people is still rising as the population expands. The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 820 million people suffered from malnourishment, up from 785 million in 2015. Overall, nearly 2 billion people face either moderate or severe food insecurity, meaning they don't have regular access to nutritious food. We do, however, know that in 2018, at least 113 million people experienced acute hunger at crisis and emergency levels. Conflict was the key driver for 74 million people, followed by climate vulnerability as the main reason for another 29 million people, and economic shocks as the primary driver for 10 million. This report underscores the complex interplay among climate change, conflict, and economic stagnation, and their combined impact on malnourishment. In drought-ravaged parts of Central America, for instance, a prolonged drought is stoking higher hunger rates and migration to the region's cities and northward to the United States. In its latest annual progress report on the 17 Sustainable Development Goals set by global leaders in 2015, the UN said the world was not on track to achieve the first two goals, reducing extreme poverty and ending hunger, largely because of climate change. The key to reducing hunger rates will be helping small-scale farmers become more resilient and better equipped to withstand climate-related weather extremes. But it noted that government spending on agriculture and aid to farmers from member countries of the OECD has fallen precipitously since the 1980s. Last week, the OECD, along with the Food and Agriculture Organization, published another report showing that agriculture production is expected to rise 15% over the next decade, largely because of technological advancements. Much of the expected increase in crop production will go towards livestock, feeding a growing demand for protein and dairy products, especially from developing countries and China. That means agriculture's carbon footprint will continue to be significant. The findings also point to another important problem in global food distribution, that while agricultural production is on the rise, adequate nutrition does not always reach people equally. Frankly, we already produce over 4 billion tons of food annually, of which a third is wasted, Hassan of the World Food Program explained. Bottom line, we produce more than enough to feed everyone today despite all this waste. Increasing production is good, but it won't solve the hunger problem unless we make food affordable and accessible to all, particularly those living in conflict-stricken places around the world. And it's not just food, it's water. Next up, taps run dry for half of Zimbabwe's capital city, affecting millions. More than 2 million people in and around Zimbabwe's capital city, Harare, are currently without access to municipal drinking water, the result of a years-long drought and high water pollution levels, Climate Change News reported. With their taps running dry, residents are instead relying on merchants, open wells, streams, and boreholes for water. According to Harare City Authority, just 50% of the 4.5 million people in the capital and its four satellite towns currently have access to municipal water. Two of the four dams that supply water to the city have run dry, leading to a reliance on heavily polluted water from the two remaining dams. Harare's mayor told Climate Change News that the city was producing only 450 million liters of water a day, less than half of its daily demand. Community organizers believe that actual supply is closer to 100 million liters. Zimbabwe is one of several major cities around the world facing water shortages, in large part due to climate change and an increase in extreme drought in recent years. Municipal water lines in the Indian city of Chennai, population 8 million, have recently run dry. In Zimbabwe, meteorologists say rains are not expected in Harare until October at the earliest. Earlier this month, officials told residents that the city will not be able to provide municipal water once a week. The limited water still available for city use is highly contaminated by raw sewage, garbage, and agricultural, mining, and industrial waste, officials said, requiring expensive water treatment before it can be sent into city pipes. Okay, sorry about ending on bad news here, people. But if you have questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's toppun.com. And if you'd like to revisit this show or any previous show or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.